Please be seated. Good to see everybody. Final case for today is case number 69030, Hong v. Doan. Mr. Posenberg for the appellant, Mr. Willick for the respondent. Mr. Posenberg.
Have at it. Thank you and good afternoon, Chief Justice Cherry. May it please the court, Dan Posenberg for the petitioner. Rule 16, although Justice Pickering at one point called it oblique, Rule 16 sets out a pretty straightforward rule that if you're going to have a stipulation, and that would include settlements, it either has to be in writing and subscribed, or it has to be entered by consent as an order in the minutes of the court.
What about the stipulation submitted to settle the case, even though it didn't describe the terms of the settlement? Is that qualifying under Rule 16 that might bootstrap it in?
Well, and that's what the majority of the Court of Appeals try to do is bootstrap it in, and I don't think it qualifies at all for two reasons. It didn't set out the terms, and it expressly said, as one of the other opinions from this court says, that a written stipulation with the agreement and the terms would follow. So here's what the Court of Appeals did.
Wait a second, Mr. Posenberg. Are you saying, as a proposition of law, that you cannot have a valid settlement agreement that is not fully incorporated in the stipulation in order to dismiss?
No. You can't. If you enter a stipulation and have the primary terms in there, then you're at your peril there for not having agreed to other conditions.
Well, let's say they had out of court a complete settlement agreement, whether it's oral or written, but they had a complete valid settlement agreement, and they just went and told the court, we've settled this, and we're going to dismiss it. We will present you with a separate dismissal order.
The court enters
the order on it and approves that as a stipulation.
Well, that's not effective to be a settlement agreement because it doesn't set out the terms of the agreement.
CCR 16 require that the terms of the agreement be set out?
Well, if you don't set out the terms, then you haven't entered into a stipulation settling the case. You've simply entered into a stipulation continuing the trial. When people come to Judge Gonzalez in business court and say, we have an agreement, we've settled the case, you can take the trial off, she says, well, when you have a written agreement as to the terms of the agreement, then I will take the trial.
But the parties here stipulated that it stipulated and agreed that the parties have come to a stipulated resolution of all matters and shall submit a separate order to the court reflecting the terms of the settlement that they have come to. And then there's an order that says the above stipulation is hereby rendered as an order of the court.
But it's simply an order continuing the trial.
I don't know.
Unless you set out the terms. And so, you don't have a stipulation as to the terms. I just settled a case almost a month ago with Mr. Edgar for almost $9 million. The trial was going on in front of Judge Eric Johnson. We were upstairs with Judge Tagliati trying to resolve the case. We went down and we made a record of all the terms. And they kept moving. Because if they're important terms to you, you have to put them in as the agreement. And we were doing it in open court. I wanted a confidentiality agreement. I thought we had agreed to it. He says, no, no deal with a confidentiality agreement. I say, okay, I'll give it up. I want to be able to approve the sureties who do the annuity. He says, no, it can't be an AIG company. We agree on New York Life. I say that he needs to resolve the hospital liens. We come out with a way to resolve that. If you go through and resolve the material conditions, then you have an agreement. But to go to the judge and say, we have an agreement, when there isn't an agreement to all the material terms. Tom Standish, Dr. Fung's lawyer.
Well, let's say that there was an agreement as to all material terms. I mean, that's a point of dispute as between both sides in this case, and I understand that.
Yeah.
But let's say there was reached at the mediation a complete agreement and somebody just got buyer's remorse and decided they wanted to back out.
Right.
Is that enforceable on this record?
No, it isn't.
Okay.
Not in the proceeding itself. No, it isn't. Now,
you don't think they can prove the oral agreement in a hearing and motion to enforce in front of the court?
Well, that's the problem. And that's the problem here. I mean, there's that dicta in Resnick that says maybe you can bring a separate lawsuit. and try to enforce the contract. But there's, this court has never actually said that that's what the proper procedure is to do. Instead, what the court has said, the court said it in Resnick, the court said it in Grisham, and that you have to give the court an efficient method for determining genuine settlements and enforcing them. And that's Rule 16. If you don't have it all written out, and you go to the court and say, we have an agreement, and you don't express the terms, you do not have an enforceable agreement.
Okay, so but the district court didn't have an evidentiary hearing on this on March 17th.
And I think Rule 16 is actually designed so you don't have to do evidentiary hearings.
You have to, but it doesn't preclude it.
I think Rule 16 is designed so you don't come to the point where you are doing evidentiary hearings.
But wouldn't that flesh out a lot of the terms of the reported agreement?
No, and that's the problem that I have. It's page 3 of the Court of Appeals decision. They take part of logic and part of logic. They say the compliance, the satisfaction of Rule 16 is the signed stipulation combined with the evidence admitted at the hearing. And that's, well, that's not what Rule 16 says. Rule 16 doesn't provide for that. Taking something.
Rule 16 governs the dismissal on agreement by the parties, but the terms of the settlement, why can't those be arrived at and proven in an evidentiary hearing like any other oral contract?
Well,
I understand there's arguments about statutes of fraud,
right.
But I don't see by their terms or historically that they would apply to this case where that you already had a marital settlement agreement, it was final. This is not the transfer of real property. Why isn't this?
Chapter 123 provides that agreements having to do with marriages and divorces have to be in writing. That's a statute.
Yeah, but your parties are already divorced.
It's still a settlement that would come in having to do, it's still in contemplation of a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't argued that at length because, as you pointed out in Grisham, Rule 16 satisfies the statute of frauds.
It does, but you're saying Rule 16 wasn't satisfied here.
It wasn't satisfied here. How can we have a rule that satisfies the statute of frauds as to resolutions of divorces when we're interpreting the rule not to require anything to be in writing, not to require the terms to be in writing?
Mr. Posner, I guess my concern from a practical point, I understand your legal argument and all, and Resnick and what it says, but a lot of these cases, especially in family law cases, the parties mediate maybe late at night. You've got a mediator, expensive mediator there with them. They try and hammer something out. They can't stipulate on the record because it's in an office late at night.
And you just put it in writing.
Okay, but what writing would suffice, though, is the key. I know you're going to say the material terms, but what how can we handle this to encourage
together? The only reason Mr. Kamen didn't do a settlement agreement in that case is because he had a scheduling issue. Mm-hmm. But normally, and I know Mr. Kamen just told me out in the lobby, he's done it in every case except for two. And the other one was my case. What you do is you sit there and you write it out. Just like Judge Gonzalez says, if you want to continue the trial, you enter into a settlement agreement. And that's what Rule 16 requires. If you want to have an enforceable agreement, you can have an agreement, you can have a stipulation in court that sets out that it is memorializing the terms of the agreement, just like I did last month with Mr. Egbert. Mm-hmm. So that's what you would need to do. You can't come in and say, okay, we have a settlement, when actually what matters to you may not be resolved. Now, at the time they entered into the stipulation, Mr. Standish already knew that there was an issue with the settlement agreement, whether there was a meeting of the minds. Dr. Fung wanted two things in particular, besides the number, which maybe we could characterize as buyer's remorse, because he found out that it wasn't justified. But he also wanted a declaration that there was no wrongdoing on his part, and he did not want a mutual release. Those were material to him, just like picking the annuity was material to me in the resolution of the Pizza Hut case. So you have to be able to bang out all those details.
So let's say hypothetically Mr. Kanan stayed for 5 minutes, and the parties initial an agreement saying the financial amount is X, whatever it is,
right,
and these other two issues are not addressed. Is that enforceable?
If they sign, there's something magic about signing things. I mean, we have it in the Declaration of Independence. We have it in Rule 11. So if they put it together a document that said, okay, we agree on X amount of money, and signed it, that would be an enforceable settlement agreement. The court would be free to fill in other terms.
Okay.
But if you, it's important to you what those other terms are. Like Robert and I were fighting over what seemed to the court to be immaterial, but was very important to us, the deal wouldn't go through unless we resolve that. Unless you resolve those, and somebody doesn't sign, then, yeah, the court can't go in and fill that out.
Is it satisfied if you have a court reporter?
One of the cases from this court, there was a court reporter, but then it got entered into the minutes and approved by the judge. So, no, doing it in a deposition transcript doesn't satisfy Rule 16.
See, I agree with what Justice Gibbons says. I have the senior judges over at the Phoenix building, and they sometimes it's late at night, and they make a deal, and they expect it to be a deal. There's got to be good faith between attorneys on these settlements.
And Mr. Kanan, by the way, had no problem with the other case.
I mean, you saw how we did Hilton settlements and MGM settlements.
We signed things.
Later. But there was
they
no...
Were, yeah, but you couldn't enforce them until later. Mm-hmm. And especially so in a family law case, and that's why Chapter 123 has a statute of frauds for these kind
of
cases.
But that statute of frauds, I mean, Grisham identifies in the footnote that statute is of ancient vintage. It dates back to the late 1800s. And it uses words that were interpreted as a prospective in contemplation of marriage settlement.
Right.
So, example, I'm going to settle acreage upon my daughter as her dowry for the man who's marrying her.
I understand. I went to law school in Massachusetts, a very Catholic community where nothing is enforceable. But I think the purpose of that is the same emotional. I don't think we can say that the statute of frauds shouldn't apply because it is ancient. But what I'm saying is clearly in the chemistry in Grisham, you're looking at Rule 16 satisfying statute.
Sure, and that, because that was the facts in Grisham, but this case is two steps different.
Okay.
One, you don't have it in the minutes, and two, this is a post-marital dispute where the marital settlement agreement has already been entered and the divorce decree has been entered. So you're enforcing a previous agreement and a dispute that's arisen under it, which is pretty far afield.
Right, but here's the problem I have with well-intentioned deviations from solid rules of law. The majority in the Court of Appeals took this part and this part and said, well, that's somehow taking little pieces from everywhere you satisfy Rule 16. And then they dropped a footnote that said, okay, this is only in this case. Nobody should read this as something you can do in any other case. And, you know, I brought the governor versus the legislature opinions with me because this court did that then too and said, well, it seems to make some sense, so we're going to ignore the rule of law and apply a decent result. The result here, the good intentioned result here, cannot justify the deviation from Rule 16. I'd like to save my minute and a half for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you,
Ms. Willett.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Marshall Willett for Thule Dove, the respondent in this case. May it please the court, the resolution of this appeal was set out 36 years ago in Resnick, when this court said that if the existence of a full and complete settlement contract is disputed, the district court is to conduct a hearing examining the authority of counsel, the communications, and whether there had been a meeting of the minds. That's what was done.
So you're saying because it was the marital settlement agreement was entered into and the divorce was granted, then it's just a post-divorce proceedings and the court can resolve it evidentiary like it did in this case.
There's a huge difference between a divorce and a post-divorce. These people are legal strangers at this point, or at least she's trying to be. And that's part of the reason the actual motivations of the parties which brought the case to fruition, but I'll get to that in a bit. The petition for review to this court from the Court of Appeals raises two issues, neither one of which holds water. They boiled down and backtracked to the point where first they argue the district court was not allowed to conduct an evidentiary hearing. That's the first point. To determine whether the parties had reached a full and complete settlement. That's remarkable in light of this court's direction. Given the power to implement a settlement agreement between the parties and adheres in the district court's role as supervisor of the litigation, the exercise of that power is particularly appropriate for deferential review. You said that in Grisham. Whether a contract exists is a question of fact. That's what district courts do. And that's what this district court did. Resnick, Kukla, Hastings say that if a fact is disputed, the court is to hold a hearing and determine whether it's true or false. Second, Fung argues for the first time in his reply, which is why you don't have anything in writing from me about it, that an independent action rather than a motion was necessary before the district court could rule. And that wasn't raised at the district court level. It wasn't raised in the court of appeals. It was raised for the first time in reply in the petition for review here. You've said over and over that an assertion of law not raised at the district court level is not going to be reviewed for the first time on appeal, so there's no briefing on it. If you get past that, then you're back to the real world of family law, which you alluded to a minute ago. In the real world of family court, it doesn't make any difference how or why this case got to the district court for this evidentiary hearing. Exactly the same people would have been in front of exactly the same court with exactly the same issues, with exactly the same information, only it would have been delayed another 4, 5, or 6 months, and we would have spent a whole bunch more money to get there. There was an allusion in the petition for review to discovery. It's a false issue. If you read the record that was cited, Fung didn't ask to reopen discovery as to the agreement. The party stipulated for all the information relating to the agreement was already exchanged in both parties' possession. Nobody wanted it anymore. Fung wanted to reopen discovery for the trial that we had taken off calendar because we settled. And Judge Comments wasn't having any of that, because he'd already delayed the matter 2 years. 2 years, Kirby Wells' motion for Fung's violation of the MSA had been pending. And he stalled it again and again and again by hiring and firing half a dozen lawyers, by asking for continuance, by setting and then canceling 2 mediations. His purpose was delay. To him, this is a sport. His purpose is to remain engaged. And the longer he can keep it going, the happier he is. He's already announced this. So to leave, to get it done, went to the settlement agreement and took 50 cents on the dollar. We had provable damages. This nonsense in the briefing about there being new claims for damages, it's right there in the record. We had over $1 million in hard numbers, plus interest. We had $1.5 million in easily provable damages. We settled for 750 grand, 50 cents on the dollar. We did that to get it done.
Mr. Willick, to get a clear rule of law, if you were a member of the Supreme Court, I know you used to be on the staff, but if you were a justice on it and you were writing a decision in this case, how would you phrase it? What rule of law would you announce or reiterate to resolve this case? And I'll ask Mr. Goldsberg the same thing.
I'd announce it very simply. When this court settled Resnick in 1981, remember the DCR 16 had been passed in 1980. The rule was brand new. If there was ever going to be a time that this court was going to say this rule replaces the procedure we're setting out for having an evidentiary hearing to prove that a contract exists, it would have been right then. You would just approve the rule. But you didn't. What you said is, we have this summary procedure, which you can use, and if you do, you don't even have to have a hearing. All you have to do is show the agreement and the subscription you got. But if something's missing, for whatever reason, if something goes wrong, then you can have an evidentiary hearing and prove that a contract exists. That's what this court said. So the rule is that this has been the rule for 36 years, and it's been practice and procedure for 36 years. Mr. Poldenberg alluded to a prior case with the same set of people. Me on one side, Tom Standish on the other, Ed Keenan the mediator, and Mr. Poldenberg was in the room, and we all agreed that the terms were complete, and that a full and final settlement had been reached, that we had all terms resolved, and the actual writing didn't happen until the next day or the next day or the next day.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Bullock, but there's something that's just kind of confusing for me. There's an indication there were no writings, but in looking through this, my understanding is that Mr. Keenan met with all the parties, met with Mr. Fung, and went over a written document list and had him check off everything that was on this, that was agreed to.
There are 3 copies.
Yeah.
One written by Mr. Keenan, one written by my paralegal, and one written by Jason Mazie, who sat right next to Fung the entire day and had no contact with our side. All 3 match exactly as to every single material term. What Mr. Keenan did is shove them back and forth between them, go over those list of terms. Of course it was a writing. Those writings are the, When the stipulation and order to take the hearing on calendar was written the next day, I wrote it. I had the term sheet in my hand, which is why the thing says to be included later. Judge Pomerantz, I don't know about Judge Gonzalez's procedure, but Judge Pomerantz required an immediate submission of the stipulation and order to take the trial on calendar. We knew it would take some days to circulate the full written terms. I'm a technical writer, so quite often my opponents ask me to write the exact words, because for enforceability, they like the language to be exactly precise. So we knew that would take a couple of days. So there were two separate documents written, only for that purpose, because they had canceled the mediation and then reset it to 3 days before the trial. We only had 72 hours. So we had to get the stipulation in order and taking the trial off immediately. And then we had to circulate the written terms list. But both of them were written 12 hours after the mediation concluded and circulated because we were in complete agreement as to all material terms. So yes, there were three copies. And they were introduced at the evidentiary hearing, and Mr. Kanan and Mr. Standish and Mr. Naney all testified, along with my paralegal, that they matched exactly, that their understanding was complete, and that there were no material omitted issues. Frankly, there's been a slight misrepresentation. I probably ought to address it. Dr. Fung did not ask for there to be any other terms. There were no omitted terms. There were no vague terms. There were no missing terms.
What about, he wanted a term that stated there was no evidence of fraud or misrepresentation.
No.
And
what he wanted was no statement in the MSA that said that he had lied, cheated, and stolen. He made that very clear to Mr. Kanan, and he got exactly what he asked for. We made a point of not putting it into the proposed order. He got his term. His term is the absence
what
of the
binding. What about no releases?
There is no such negotiation. There's no term. There's no releases in the order.
Okay.
So both of them are bogus issues. That's a
what about the other thing that kind of caught my eye reading this was the testimony from Mr. Standish that when he signed the stipulation, he knew that Dr. Fung had already did not want to go forward with the agreement. It says, there's a lengthy quote that the witness, we knew of Dr. Fung's concerns at the time, what he was additionally saying that the stipulation to vacate was signed, and the reason was really my decision, blah, blah, blah.
He has other issues in his mind.
Okay.
All the issues that were an issue for the evidentiary hearing, which is scheduled for 3 days later, and the counter motion, which is scheduled for 4 days after that, every single one of those issues were resolved in the stipulation and order. Dr. Fung had other things in his mind. He wanted to punish his ex-wife. He wanted to hurt his ex-wife. He had other things he wanted to do. But there wasn't anything that was before the court that wasn't completely resolved.
So he did that testimony, and the district court didn't find this, but there was no finding that he had withdrawn the authority of the attorney to sign that stipulation.
There was no such finding, and it wouldn't be possible.
Okay.
You've got a case law for 90 years saying an attorney is bound by stipulations. Mr. Cannon and Mr. Standish walked into our room to re-go over the term list to make sure they exactly match. Mr. Standish, relying on Mr. Kanan's appointment, on Dr. Fung's behalf, he was his representative, suggested delaying the drafting of this until the next morning. We, as a matter of professionalism and civility, accepted that request. And now they're attempting, Dr. Fung, having fired his lawyers and replaced them yet again with another team of lawyers, is asking to undo that stipulation that was reliance on his attorney's representation that a full and complete settlement had been reached and start over again. And that really shouldn't be allowed. I mean, for 20 years, this court has told attorneys to trust one another, to rely on one another, to deal with one another in ADR, especially in family law matters. My word is my bond, my handshake is my seal. I mean, that's what you have told us to do. We did that, and the attorneys did not violate it. The attorneys are in uniform agreement. Every single person in that room, of the eight people present, seven people are in identity as to exactly what happened and why. That everything was settled, every material term was agreed to, every instance was covered. There was nothing unresolved.
Then why didn't the doctor sign the list? The mediator walked over with a list and checked off, is this what you understand, checked off the terms. Why didn't he have him sign it? I mean, we have this in every single case, absent a writing. We're going to have hearings in every case, evidentiary hearings, fights up here. Isn't the whole point not how people are practicing, but what is the best practice?
Possibly.
Get it signed.
And maybe Mr. Kanan will change his practices going forward, but his practice was to canvass the witness twice to make sure every material term had been accomplished, was fully resolved, fully understood, and agreed to. And he did so twice. If you look at his testimony, He was the one in control of the process. I wasn't in the room. So there wasn't any way for me to make sure that Dr. Fine initialed Mr. Kamen's or even his own lawyer's term list. But they matched exactly. His lawyer taking notes in the room exactly matched the mediator's list, which exactly matched our list in the other room. So yes, would that have been a better practice? Perhaps, but I wasn't running the mediation. I was counsel for one of the parties in one of the rooms. Mr. Kamen was running the mediation. It was his show.
Would the settlement be enforceable had there been no stipulation to vacate the trial date?
Possibly. Luckily, I don't have to answer that question because we do have a writing signed by the lawyer which
has the stipulation satisfy the expectations? Does the stipulation continuing the trial date satisfy the expectations in Grisham, which appears to require at least a recitation of material terms in writing?
It doesn't. However, it incorporates, as Grisham suggested, you can incorporate another piece of paper. And that other piece of paper was the three identical term lists. And I know they were incorporated by reference because I wrote the stipulation in order taking the trial. And I had it in my hand when I wrote it.
So I'm trying to catch up with you there. Could we go to the stipulation, Mr. Willard?
I don't have it in front of me, but yes,
sir. Oh, okay. All right. So looking at your hold on a second.
The reason it recites the stipulation in order that we have come to is that all parties knew that a full complete set. It didn't say what we're going to agree to or the terms that we're going to reach.
Right.
It referred to the term sheets we already had. Everybody had the identical terms in front of it. We all knew what the terms of the settlement were. They just wanted me to actually write the exact words because I'm something of a neurotic perfectionist, and they liked me to write the exact language in a way that would be enforceable in the future in case there was ever a misunderstanding or an alleged misunderstanding of exactly what had been agreed to. So Mr. Standish asked me to do the writing. And frankly, my client shouldn't be punished for that. There was a complete agreement, and no issue was omitted or vague. In terms of public policy, you know, what they're asking is that you take a 1980 rule and use it to overrule a 1980 case. So to answer your question, Justice Gibbons, I would say that this court knew what it was doing when it passed the rule. It knew what it was doing when it issued the opinion. And what it said is, if you want to use the summary procedure, you have to have a memorialization of all the important terms that have to be written on the minutes of the court, or it has to be subscribed by the person to be charged. If you don't have that for whatever reason, you have to have an evidentiary hearing to prove that a contract exists. That's what it says, that's what it means. And that's all that it means.
Did Standish have authority to sign the stipulation vacating the trial date?
On the day of the mediation? Yes. And the next morning, yes.
On the day he signed it?
Yes. It wasn't until later that Dr. Fung got a hold of him and said, by the way, don't sign anything, don't do anything, and by the way, you're fired.
I thought Standish's testimony was an acknowledgement that he knew of his client's objection. And notwithstanding that objection, he told Namy to sign it anyway. Wasn't that the testimony?
That's a piece of the testimony. I'd have to go back to look at the exact order. The reality is I wrote those documents at 8 o'clock in the morning and sent them over. Mr. Namy signed it, and we returned it because it had to go to Judge Pomerantz first thing in the morning, very early on. And Dr. Fung testified that it wasn't until later that he sent his attorney a note saying that he had an objection to the 750.
My concern is that the record made in front of the judge here seems to show that at the time Namy signed the stipulation, which forms, based on your argument, the basis for compliance with Rule 16, that the lawyer lacked authority from his client to sign it.
I see my time is up, but I'd like to answer your question.
Go ahead.
I can't tell you the exact timing of all this is in the Standish office, and there isn't a clear time trail for me to be able to make that proof. But assuming that this
I'm just going on the basis of what the transcript shows of his testimony.
Other testimony said slightly different things if you go to Mr. Namy's testimony. But assuming you take that as true, We have the question of ostensible authority. He wasn't fired until 3 weeks later. He was counsel with record at the moment that he signed the stipulation taking the matter off calendar And he was there for another 3 weeks. For 9 years.
In the 3 weeks, was it a substitution of attorney's sign or was it an order to withdraw?
Yes, another. Substitution of Ms. Salvatore.
But there was, so you're saying until that substitution of attorney's sign, he was still attorney?
Yes. And your case law for 90 years says that a client is bound by the actions, representations, agreements, and stipulations of his attorney. Because otherwise, we can't trust one another for anything. So I thank you. If the court has any other questions, I'll answer them. Otherwise, I thank
you. Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg, rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Justice Hardesty, yes. I even said that in my opening argument. Tom Standish was a stand-up guy, and he admitted not only that he didn't have authority from Dr. Frum to sign that, but also there were issues that had not been resolved. When the stipulation refers to another writing, I would say that it can't, it would have to refer to an agreement. It can't refer to lawyer's notes that Dr. Frum never signed. But here's what the stipulation said. It is further stipulated and agreed at page 293 of the appendix that the parties have come to a stipulated resolution of all matters and shall submit a separate order to the court reflecting the terms of the settlement they have come to. So clearly, the stipulation isn't referring to lawyers' notes. It's referring to an actual order, and that's what the stipulation would need to get around Rule 16. Counsel cites Kukla and Hastings. Those are out-of-state cases that do not have a Rule 16, so we don't have that issue. Counsel's also argued that we should have deferential review. No. No, because I'm arguing a legal point. I'm arguing here's what Rule 16 requires. And all this factual dispute that I'm hearing from the other side of the aisle just proves why we should follow Rule 16. So we don't have this kind of gobbledygook about what the facts are. Justice Gibbons, you asked me for a rule of law, and it's on page 5 of the district court's opinion. It's Justice Silver dissenting. She says, quoting Humana, even when there is an actual agreement, a court may not consider the agreement when, quote, it is neither reduced to a signed writing nor entered by consent as an order. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bussenberg, please sit down. Mr. Wallach made a very important point at the end, and that is the stipulation of counsel. Who is counsel? And our practice has relied upon stipulations of the parties making reference to settlements.
Two answers.
Do we disregard that practice? And you've eloquently talked about 90 years of practice and all this other stuff, but that is the way the profession is run. Now, the attorney sometimes has to be aware. They make that representation, but they do so, I would hope, based upon the representation of their consultation with their client. They are their representatives at that time.
I think actually that stipulation was just to get the trial continued. I don't think that its intent was to lay out the terms.
I understand that's what you think, but based upon the other things of the mediator going through and having it checked off by other parties, I think it is a little bit more than that. But having said that, do we just throw out the time-honored fact that counsel has the ability to bind their client?
No, that can't be right. If I give the other side an extension of time to do something, that's within the realm of my authority as an attorney. I can't settle a client's case. Remember the movie The Untouchables, where the lawyer stands up and says, I want to change Al Capone's plea from not guilty to guilty, and the federal marshals take him away. He had no authority to do that. A lawyer is allowed to do certain things, but not other things. We forget that the cases belong to the clients.
Well, counsel, I ask that question every day since you're in the criminal vernacular, we have an attorney representing to the court that his client does not want to die when the client has said they want to die.
And I've done those kinds of cases, and I am fully aware of how the law comes differently to volunteers. And yes, I think when the opposite of my Al Capone situation. A lawyer does not have the ability to say, I want to change the guilty plea.
So,
as a court,
we should just disregard any representations made by counsel during any litigation in court.
No.
Where the attorney says, I understand this to be the fact. I was told, we just throw that away.
No, but I'm talking about the ultimate act of a case.
And that sometimes is an ultimate fact or an ultimate issue. Counsel says, I've been misrepresented. In this case, we have this strange situation whereby, even though it's not on the record, we have a mediator. The mediator, at some points, becomes the record almost, because he's walked through and checked it off to make sure this is the terms and conditions the parties have agreed to.
Your Honor,
why are we
going to
throw that out?
Your Honor, Tom Standish was very clear that those two conditions...
You're excluding Tom Standish.
No, Dr. Fung did not agree to two of the terms. Heavy sigh.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. President, I have one thing about that. Will we get the judge over to switch the juries?
And in fact, as long as you ask, he switched the jury to the next courtroom where there was a divorce case going on.
Okay.
Which is funny because it's federal court and juries are usually not in divorce cases. So, yes.
Thank you to both of the lawyers. Your skill and professionalism are outstanding, both of you. Congratulations. This case will stand.